The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. My name is Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Robert Freeman Wexler. He joins us in studio. And it's been a while since I had you on the show, Robert. What's it been, 20 years maybe?
I think 25.
It was No, not that long.
2003 or 4, oh, I don't remember.
I think it might have been 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you're back, and there's a book that apparently is back as well. Do you want to tell us the story about what the deal is with this book and when it originally came out and why it's just been reissued?
The why, that's a hard question. It originally came out in 2009 from a very small publisher in England who do very fancy, expensive editions so that it's harder for people to afford them. Mm. So also harder to get readers.
Mm-hmm.
But so there were about 100 really expensive slipcase cover signed copies and I think 350 less expensive hardcovers, and that's all sold out and been sold out for years. And I was looking for a long time for a U.S. publisher and eventually found one, and here we have it.
There were 450 copies, and that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
100 really fancy ones, and then 350, what were they? Paperbacks?
No, they were hardcovers. They were essentially the same as the fancy one, except without a slipcase or a dust jacket or ribbon. So the fancy one had a ribbon in it.
And the fancy one was signed?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, all of them were signed.
Oh, okay.
Now they don't sign the less fancy ones, but they used to have everybody sign. Like, there was an introducer, the introducer and I both signed the fancy one, and
the introducer, like the person who wrote the introduction?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And the book is called The Painting and the City, and it's just been reissued in a paperback for more of a mass market.
Yes, and also ebook for even whoever those people are who
So there never
like
was an ebook
books.
Either?
No.
Okay.
No.
And what is it about this book that you were able to get someone to republish it? What was the vibe, the attraction that made them desire to do this endeavor?
Well, it's a publisher who runs a small press called Verse Chorus, which does a little bit of fiction and books on various bands and stuff. There's a book they recently published on REM's early years and whatever. And it's just someone I sent it to years ago, and he really liked it a lot but couldn't figure out a way to sell it. He didn't think he wanted to print enough copies to please his distributor. He just wasn't sure. He you know, about selling fiction well. So, but then he came up with an idea for a new line of books that he uses print on demand, and it's just sort of more unusual books that have a niche but haven't completely found everyone in that niche. And just over the years, he kept thinking about it as a book he'd like to publish someday, and so the day came.
Mm-hmm. So he's doing fiction now?
A little bit. The niche is, it's called the Visible Spectrum, and it's not all fiction. One of them books is a reprint of a book on Australian music. I think there's a book of poetry, a graphic novel.
Sounds like whatever. Sounds like a really hip publisher.
Yeah, he is.
And they're called The Visible Spectrum, and this looks like it's number 7 on this imprint from this particular line. All right, The Painting and the City. How did you get the idea for this story?
Well, that's another hard one because I wrote it so long ago. But I think originally I was thinking about a short story of just sort of art mystery, I guess, but then as I thought about it, realized it's a lot more than a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's like all my books. They come together from a few ideas, and I work on them, and then there's a book. So, and in this one, I knew that the city was important. And that was sort of the first character, really, was the city that I thought of. And then the painting, and what happens next. So,
and the city is New York City.
Yes.
And you have a lot of themes in this story. And we're seeing things mostly from the viewpoint of a sculptor.
Yes.
Named Lerner.
Yes.
And this gentleman has a little bit in common with you. He was a kid from Texas, right?
Right.
Just like you?
Yes.
Didn't you grow up in Houston?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I managed to, you know, slip in some autobiographical things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sort of a, if I'd, like, I think I had him maybe go to the University of Texas briefly and then go to New York. So it's sort of a, if that had been me, if I hadn't stuck it out in Texas and, you know, I didn't move to New York till the 90s. So, you know, let's say he was me but went to New York a lot earlier.
So you do have living experience in New York City.
Yeah.
And how long did you live there?
About 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, so much of this is about the city that it became and how that happened. Do you want to talk at all about that, about how New York City came to be? And in your book, we get the sense that the way New York City was laid out, the way they set up the grid, the way it was transformed from a really beautiful place, a natural place, to this weird grid, was emulated and spread throughout the country. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, it's sort of, well, you know, our traditional way of imposing ourselves on the landscape, you know, in this country especially, just that, and the idea that it could have been done differently. And if it had been done differently, maybe the whole country would be different now. As, you know, just flattening a city and putting a grid on it when it had a completely different landscape doesn't make any sense.
Was it the original Dutch settlers that devised this plan, or the descendants of the Dutch?
No, it was the English or the, you know, Americans who came from the English.
Okay.
Because that was, the grid was made in, I think, 1821 or something.
Okay. Well, we have all these descendants of the Dutch in your story.
Yeah.
And there's two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of the villains in the story.
Yeah.
And they're of Dutch descent.
Yeah. I thought I created sort of secret sort of history of Dutch control. I mean, financial control, which, I mean, isn't all that secret, and that they were the original people, and the original people with money, and they continued to have money, and, you know, even on through, you know, the Roosevelts were, you know, Dutch. So, and I made them evil, and not evil, but, you know, it's an art versus commerce kind of thing, and they're the commerce side. So,
well, it's very much about what we're seeing in art and commerce merging, and the commodification of art, where people are saying, oh, this real estate's a great investment. Oh, this sculpture is a great investment. This Jeff Koons sculpture is a great investment. They don't think of it as art. They think of it as just something to move around like a stock or a bond.
Yeah, pretty much. That's my thinking on it, at least. And I have him making the usual trade-offs you have to make to survive, because, you know, in the end, he has to sell them a piece of his art.
You're talking about Lerner, the sculptor.
Yeah, right, in that.
Well, he doesn't want to sell them a piece of his art. And the piece of his art very much describes what he hates the most about them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a work of fantasy. Do you want to talk about the fantasy aspect? Because you've got a lot of hallucinatory, visionary type of stuff going on in this story.
Yeah. It's to me a fantasy. It depends on who the reader is, of course. Generally, the sort of reader of genre fantasy wouldn't see it as a fantasy so much.
Mm-hmm.
And the reader of realism would, and it falls somewhere in between those. And pretty much all my writing does. I like the real world mostly. It's set in the real world with just these various elements that intrude into things and into people who aren't accustomed to that.
And there's a lot of messaging in here. As I mentioned, the commodification of art, the way we laid out our cityscapes, and the increasing divide between the haves and the have-nots. That's a big part of the story.
Yeah, and that's, of course, 12 years ago. Just everything in that is worse now.
Mm-hmm. And that's important to you.
Yeah, yeah. I don't feel like there's anything I can do about it exactly, but it's important.
Mm-hmm. In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Robert Freeman Wexler. We're talking about his novel, The Painting and the City, which has just been reissued. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, amplifying voices from every corner of our community. And Robert has an event. I can't remember the last time I said that on the air where an author had an event other than like a Zoom thing. You actually have an event coming up on Tuesday, August 10th at 7 p.m. here in Yellow Springs at the Underdog Cafe, kind of a book rollout for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's going to be going
celebration.
On? Yeah.
It's I'll read, and we'll have the Emporium House Band of Kurt Miyazaki and Michael Caselli playing guitar and other found sounds and beats from found sounds. I think Michael, who's working on the esoterica part of it, has done something with a recording of my reading. He's reversed it and using it as a background rhythm, and lots of fun things like that.
So he's recorded your voice and he's running the tape backwards?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I think William Burroughs would be happy about that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going to be fun. It's assuming it actually happens, just with case counts going back up.
Oh, now it's coming right up. What do you mean?
Yeah. Oh, just the, you know, Delta variant, all that stuff.
Oh, come
you
on.
Know.
We're going to have to do this event. It's just on Tuesday. It's just
just
a couple days away at the Underdog Cafe, 233 Xenia Avenue. That's Tuesday, 7 p.m. Robert is going to be doing a reading accompanied by these musicians. Now, isn't Michael Caselli a sculptor? Isn't that one of his things? That seems kind of fitting that, that he's doing this.
Yeah, I think it's great just because he's always, you know, he's worked in sculpture and theater sound and stage and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And in a way, he could be the character, you know. His...
Okay. I think that he would probably sock the marionette and that would be the end of that.
Yeah, probably.
I think so. Do you want to talk at all about the marionette, or is that just too much of a spoiler?
It's all right. It's one of the, you could call, fantasy elements. Lerner encounters a glass marionette that when he first encounters it, it appears, it's in a puppet show and probably has strings. I never say it does. It just, his perception would be that it has strings because, you know, how would it not? Uh-huh. But when he meets it after that, it's very clearly doesn't. And also it talks to him.
Uh-huh. And it keeps popping up.
Yeah, yeah. And popping up in history because he discovers there's a journal by a painter who, well, he goes to a party, sees a painting, he's transfixed by it and finds out more about the artist. And there's a journal from 1842 and 1849 in Indonesia. So it's a part in New York, part in Indonesia, and the glass marionette is part of that.
Uh-huh. And the painting is part of the title, The Painting and the City. That's the painting. The city is New York. This artist came over from Amsterdam.
Yes.
He was commissioned to do this painting, and then many years later, 150 years later, Lerner sees the painting, and there's something about it that just freaks him out. Mm. He's looking at the painting. It's a painting of a beautiful woman, and he's completely transfixed, obsessed with this painting.
Right.
And that's how he has to track down the journal. He goes to all these efforts to locate this missing journal that this painter had written. And you really had fun with this journal. I love the way that you introduced it, and then you bring back another section of it. And this really, it reminded me a lot of Edgar Allan Poe. And I know that you've been inspired in some degree by Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, especially that second journal section. I was really trying to get a very Poe feel for that.
Well, you did.
Yeah.
And I got to the end of the book and I saw you mention Edgar Allan Poe. And I said, yeah, okay, I was getting it. The book is The Painting in the City by Robert Freeman Wexler. The last time we had you on was for your novella. Do you want to talk at all about your other work?
Yeah, I had that novella was my first book, and then I had another novel that deserves to be forgotten. And
why is that?
I was just, it was okay. I'm glad it got published, but it feels very amateurish to look back at it.
Is that the one that should have stayed in the drawer?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was the name of it?
The Circus of the Grand Design.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's parts I probably still like if I was brave enough to look at it again, but...
Well, what is it about it that you feel is inferior?
Probably the structure. Probably there was something that never quite worked and never figured out why, and no one else ever, you know, helped me or pointed it out or whatever. Uh-huh. I don't know.
Well, in your notes on this book, The Painting in the City, I got the feeling that you maybe did a little bit of fine-tuning on this second edition.
A little bit, not very much.
Yeah. What kind of changes did you make?
Mostly just a few sentence structure things, and not typos exactly, but just word choice, little bits, nothing really big.
Uh-huh. This was the editor at this new press who...
Yeah, there were some, he found some, you know, a few little like typo-ish things or things, you know, like usage issues, whatever. So he read it through pretty carefully. I read it through again out loud and found some things. He found some things and, you know, we put this together.
We can always find a typo if we look hard enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Every once in a while I'll read a book that doesn't have a single typo in it that I've noticed and I'm just amazed.
Mm-hmm.
You just so rarely see that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I can find a typo in any book. I don't care. These books that have been reissued multiple times, you can still find typos in them. You think the third or fourth edition that they would have cleaned that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what kind of stuff do you like to read?
Probably similar to what I write. Just things with some sort of fantasy-ish element or, if not to use the word fantasy, but unreal element.
Are there any names that you could mention?
Yeah, I mean, the traditional, like, all-time favorite, people like Angela Carter, who's a British writer who died, like, 20-something years ago, more than 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And currently reading a book that I'm really enjoying called, it also came out in 2009 when this did, that I just got around to reading, called The Manual of Detection by Jedediah Barry. And it's a, you know, has some... I guess Calvino-esque in some ways, you could say. It's set in an unnamed city with a, you know, there's some mystery involved. And it's very, I've read about half of it. So, you know, I could end up hating it, but probably not.
You like Calvino.
Yeah.
Any other names that we can write down as we're listening?
Jeffrey Ford. He's a good writer. He wrote the introduction to the first edition of this. Daryl Gregory. Who's had several novels published and several sort of screenplays in progress of some of his fiction that nothing, you know, he's sort of a about to become bigger name kind of thing, but he's a really good writer. Like there's people who, you know, you deserve whatever success they get.
Well, that's a good list. Those are names I'm not very familiar with. I saw you yesterday on the street and you mentioned that, you had been reading The Black Tongue Thief by Christopher Buhlmann.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, now I haven't read. I was listening to your interview.
Oh, okay. Well, we had him on the show.
Yeah, and I heard him read from it
A
few years, when he was still working on it. So I haven't actually read the book yet.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
it's a fun book.
Yeah, yeah. It sounded fun what he read from it.
It was fun when he did the reading in here because he really got into character.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was the voice of the thief.
Yeah, he's... Well, he's an actor. He can, do anything.
And if you want to hear that interview, just go to our podcast archive at wyso.org and look for The Black Tongue Thief by Christopher Buhlman. You might not be able to spell Buhlman, but I bet you could spell
I can't spell.
Black Tongue. It's one word. And we have hundreds of podcasts there online at wyso.org. You can listen to at your leisure. I was talking to a woman downtown the other day, and she said, I go to bed with you every night. And I said, not so loud. She says, I'm listening to your podcast. I said, oh, thank you very much. She's a sweet lady. You know, it's nice to hear that. A lot of people, I guess, listen and go to sleep because the sound of my voice just puts them to sleep.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're a novelist. What else do you do? Do you want to talk at all about your day job, where you live, anything like that? Anything personal, or is that secret?
Everything's secret. Okay. No, I do graphic design, mostly book design, do book interior layout and design.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And what kinds of books are these?
University presses, small presses, really anything.
Mm-hmm. And do you do this for a company, or are you a freelancer? How do you do it?
Totally freelance.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And how do people find you?
Word of mouth? Yeah, word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I try to find them. It's usual scrambling for work.
Mm-hmm. You know. Are there any academic presses that I would have heard of?
University of Iowa.
Oh,
Press,
nice.
And Texas Christian University.
Oh, wow.
And that's about it.
So
some other here and there.
They keep
things,
coming back to you with additional projects.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, the University of Iowa Press, that's a great press.
Yeah.
Yeah. And TCU, I don't think I've seen anything on that press. What kind of stuff do
they? They're fairly small. Uh-huh. Texas history sorts of things. Did a book on how fracking is tearing apart Fort Worth and Texas.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. That was, cover art and had to make the, fracking well and had to dingy up a picture of the Fort Worth skyline because it was too pretty.
I see. So this is Photoshop that you're working with?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's more, I don't do cover stuff that much. This particular book, that's what I was doing, and the interior. But
wow. I had no idea. So you're really in the publishing biz.
Yeah.
As a writer, as a creator, and as a creator of cover art and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, and I understand that you're married to a writer who has a new novel coming out.
That's right.
Do you want to publicize what she's up to at all, or want to hide that under a bushel basket?
No, it's her name's Rebecca Cooter. Her first novel's coming out this fall. It's called The 8 Mile Suspended Carnival, and it's a carnival novel. It's strange. Not surprisingly, we both write strange fiction, looking forward to seeing it out there.
Well, back before all the shutdowns, I used to see her frequently in the Underdog Cafe writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we've let the cat out of the bag here. You and Rebecca live here in Yellow Springs.
Yeah. Now people can find us.
Yeah. Well, I can remember going to your wedding reception, and you had Jack Hardy singing. And that was just such a special thing because you had treated me to Jack Hardy earlier. He was in town. Were you the one designing his album cover?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I never
coming back together.
Well,
now.
I heard he was in town getting his album cover designed, but I didn't realize it was you who was doing it. Okay.
Yeah.
And what an artist he was! What an amazing man!
Yeah.
To have him come in the studio and perform, that was just such a magical thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's been gone, 10 years now?
Yeah, exactly. 10 or a little more. Yeah. It was 2011, I think.
Yeah, well, I think he would have enjoyed this book.
Yeah, well, he has it, or had it, I assume.
Okay.
I can't remember. I'm sure he read it after, because we would send each other, books, albums, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, because he was still around at the time it came out.
Well, he was famous in New York for these weekly get-togethers he would have at his apartment where all these songwriters would come and they would sing a song.
Yeah.
a lot of people that went on to become pretty well known.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was also famous for having this rent control department, right?
Right. That, I think it's still in the family. I think his son lives there. I'm not positive, but I think so.
Well, in a city like New York, and we get this from your book, if you don't have access to some way to get a break on your rent, it's pretty hard to afford to live in places like Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And even Brooklyn, Brooklyn's turned into a yuppie paradise, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was reading something yesterday. There was a woman who had moved out of New York to some town in New Jersey. I can't remember. But now, because, you know, rent has gone down a little bit.
Oh, did COVID. It during the pandemic?
Yeah. So she's back. She found a one-bedroom apartment for, I don't know, $1,400 a month or something, which I guess is cheap compared to what it was like a year ago or 2 years ago, whatever. Uh-huh. And just,
oh yeah,
it's just hard to imagine having to devote that much of your paycheck to your rent. But
and then in your book, we have these people who are just burning money.
Yeah.
People who can afford to live in New York City, the people who are buying these $50 million penthouse apartments.
Mm-hmm.
The disparity is just amazing.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. I personally could not live in New York, and it's because I have to be asleep in a quiet place. Mm-hmm. And we get a little bit of this from Lerner at one point. He's saying, even if you live in a area that's kind of away from all the hubbub, that you still get that undercurrent of noise at night. And the few times I've stayed in New York overnight, 3 a.m., you hear the garbage truck, you hear the sirens, you hear all this, and the people that live there, they're totally inured to it.
Yeah.
But for somebody like me, who's used to living in a quiet place, I couldn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. And I mean, of course, you get used to it. It doesn't, getting used to it doesn't mean it's not affecting your mind and body and all that.
But right. Well, we're very accustomed to where we are, and I'll stay here for now.
Yeah.
The book is The Painting and the City, written by Robert Freeman Wexler. It's just been reissued in a beautiful new paperback. Now, is this the original cover?
No. No, it was new for this edition. Okay. The publisher and I came up with the idea, I think. I can't remember. So I think I found the art and he wanted to combine it with the map like that, which I think works pretty well. Also, the color of it, because the visible spectrum part of that is the theme of each book has a different sort of base color.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
This is sort of a lime green.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can hear Robert reading at this multimedia event on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock here in Yellow Springs at the Underdog Cafe. That's 233 Xenia Avenue. You might want to arrive early to get a good seat.
Yeah, and we're also hoping to stream it from the Emporium's Facebook page.
Okay.
There's an event page created for it, and assuming all goes well, we can stream it for whoever isn't here.
Very ambitious.
Yeah.
That's Tuesday night, August 10th. 7 p.m. The Underdog Cafe, 233 Xenia Avenue, Robert Freeman Wexler, with the rollout of this new reissue of The Painting and the City. Robert, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Vic.